Welcome to the iLEAP's Early Careers podcast, where we explore scientific research related to the biosphere and the atmosphere, and share the personal experiences of our early careers scientists as they navigate their way through academia.
Hi, my name is Tichomir, and I am an iLEAP's Early Career Committee representative for Europe. Today's podcast forms part of a series in which we chat with people from a range of roles within and outside of academia, and who are both in and from the region of Europe.
Today, on the podcast, we have Simon Clark, who is a science communicator. So he has a YouTube channel, he writes a blog, also has his own podcast, and he did a PhD in atmospheric science. So welcome Simon to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's really great to have you here. I think your situation is when it comes to science and people who do PhDs is a bit very special because you chose to pursue a science communication career. So, but first, I would really like to ask you for the first question, like, what inspired you to get into science?
So I was a kid who I had the problem of finding everything interesting. Every subject in school I wanted to learn more about. And I remember when you get to the age of sort of 14 or 16 and you have to narrow down the subjects that you choose, it was really, really hard. And the only constant through every choice that I made was I knew I wanted to do science. It was just from really quite a young age, I found something fascinating about specifically the way that the world works. And I mean that on a sort of fundamental level in terms of physics, but also in terms of the larger scale, how the continents have arrived at their current positions, how the ocean works, how the atmosphere works. And I knew that I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in that. Something clearly happened in my deep childhood that made me fascinated by the natural world, and specifically, I think, fascinated with sort of the fundamental building blocks of physics, which is what I ended up doing at university. Though I didn't know that for the longest time. I knew I was interested in science, but it was actually only when you get to the age of 14 in the UK and they separate out into, up until that age in school, you just do science lessons. And then from 14 to 16, you have chemistry, biology, and physics. And when they gave out the sheets sort of saying, this is what you're going to be doing this year in each of these different subjects, I remember thinking really clearly, oh, well, you know, all the cool stuff's in physics. I guess that's what I like. And so that was, you know, that sort of decided for me, right, I'm going to do this at a higher level. I'm going to do it at a university, and then I'm going to do a PhD in it. So, you know, it's just been a fun, it's been always been there in my life.
Yeah. Can you tell the listeners more specifically about the research that you did during your PhD?
Sure. So my PhD was under Mark Baldwin and David Stevenson at the University of Exeter. And we were looking at coupling between the stratosphere and the troposphere. So the atmosphere has multiple layers stacked on top of each other, defined by the temperature distribution. So the troposphere gets colder as you get higher up, whereas the stratosphere actually stays the same temperature as you increase in altitude, and it actually starts to get warmer with altitude. And then other stuff happens above that, but who cares? And what my research was looking at was how the stratosphere forces the weather in the troposphere in the aftermath of these events called sudden stratospheric warmings, which are take place when the polar vortex, the stratospheric polar vortex, this huge donut-shaped circulation of air over the North Pole that forms every winter in either hemisphere in winter, about six times a decade perhaps, that breaks apart and it sort of just disappears, which when it's a circulation the size of a continent that's spinning at 200 kilometers per hour has some knock-on effects. And my research specifically was looking at the effects that those sudden warming events have on the troposphere, and more specifically I was constructing a new way of looking at the system and deriving some equations that allowed you to interpret what was going on in that system, which, to cut out a bunch of technical details, basically boiled down to, it was a non-linear interaction. It wasn't as simple as the stratosphere told the troposphere what to do and vice versa. There was actually an interference term with stratospheric information and tropospheric information combining to be a huge influence on surface level weather, which was something that nobody, as far as me or my examiners or supervisors could determine, nobody had found before, which was really cool.
Yeah, that sounds really, really interesting. It's always amazing when you get to find something new during your PhD. It's such an exciting scientific discovery.
Which was kind of cool because the way that we did it was actually simplify the problem down. The way that atmospheric scientists typically like to work is in quite advanced statistical methods and treating things in terms of principal components, time series, and imperial orthogonal functions, and you're dealing with this huge complicated system, and obviously that is correct. But what we did was just simplify it down to, right, you've got an Arctic region and we're going to consider that as the average of everything that happens within it, and then we're going to look at the boundary between that Arctic region and everywhere else in the atmosphere and break it down into a flux of stuff going across that boundary, which was something that I think nobody had done before because it was too simple. And it's a quite an engineering physics-y way of approaching it as a problem, I think. But very like Newtonian mechanics, like nuts and bolts, meat and potatoes kind of thinking, which I think for a lot of problems isn't appropriate. But in this case, yielded something that was new, which was, I'm not saying that everybody should just resort to simple, brutal methods, but it worked for me.
That's great. Sometimes less really is more.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what's really interesting is that you chose to pursue another career after your PhD. So you didn't decide to to do a postdoc or some other research position, but you rather chose to do a science communication career. So can you tell the listeners more about your career progression? What led you to the position you are now in?
Yeah, so it's something that actually I think to understand, you actually have to go back a couple of years, because when I was doing my undergraduate, I started making YouTube videos. And I actually made one YouTube video because I thought that was the only thing I was going to do. I did that because I was going to the University of Oxford, which is a very prestigious elitist institution. But I went there as a student from a state school background, so not from a private school. And I thought that I could be helpful to kids who were in my situation the previous year when I started at the university, and saying, oh, okay, right, I know how this system works. I know how the interviews work and what life is like here now. So I just made one video explaining, right, if you were like me, this is what I did, this is what worked, this is what didn't work. And it just sort of took off a bit. It got a couple of hundred views and I enjoyed the process of making it. So I made another video and another and another. And by the time I started my PhD, I actually had a couple of thousand followers on YouTube, and I've made dozens, I think, of videos at that point. And I just carried on making videos through the PhD. And it got to the point where at the end of the PhD, as I filmed, naturally, submitting my thesis, and as I was sort of, coming out of academia, I knew there was an opportunity to try and do it full time. It wasn't something that I anticipated would be a success, but it's something that I knew I would regret not trying to do, because I really enjoyed the process of making videos and of talking to people about science in video format. And it was sort of just a leap of faith, really, that I took, saying, science is great. I didn't have the best time during the PhD. I don't think I think I probably would have applied for a postdoc had the YouTube not been an option. I probably would have carried on that track and tried perhaps moving field slightly. But it was the opportunity that was there. I knew I'd regret not doing it. And so I just took that leap. And now this has been what I've been doing for the past 4 years.
Yeah, so I can imagine that having a job like that carries a lot of difficulties. So I was wondering, how did you overcome the biggest challenges of being a science communicator?
Oof. I mean, well, there's the thing here, which is the challenges of being a science communicator, and then there's the challenges of being self-employed. And actually, I think there's a lot of similarities between doing a PhD and being self-employed, because at the end of the day, during the PhD, yes, you have a supervisor who sort of prods you in the right direction, but you are your own boss. You are the person that has to make the decisions, and you know, ultimately, if something is going to work or not work, it comes down to you. And that's exactly the same as being self-employed. So I actually felt like it was very good training for that. But it, much like the PhD as well, there is that problem of knowing where to separate out work and life. And also having worked from home now for a couple of years, I was doing it before it was cool in the pandemic. There's a real struggle there between being able to put a hard boundary of when you stop working at the end of the evening, or you know, whenever you, or late morning, or whenever it's going to be, but having that sharp divide between your life as a human being on planet Earth and your life as worker of your own company, that was really tough, and it's something that I've been struggling with for a while. And certainly, the more popular the videos I've been getting and the more projects I've been taking on and trying to write a book alongside it and live stream and do a podcast, it just sort of slightly swamped my life. And the most difficult thing, I think, has been learning how to find that balance and also trusting somebody else to do some of the work for me. So I've recently, in the past couple of months, taken on an editor full time who helps me with the YouTube videos, which is a huge, huge, you know, weight off my mind. That's basically like a full time job for somebody to go through and edit better than I could and with more attention than I could before. And you know, probably something I should have done a couple of years ago, really, but it was learning to trust that somebody else could do that and let go of my baby of this YouTube channel and this kind of online kind of image, I suppose, that I've worked for years and years to cultivate. And just to be able to pass that off to somebody was not easy, but I'm very, very glad I did it. But yeah, I think it's been time management and also that work-life management that are the most difficult things about doing this from as any self-employed business. In terms of science communication, I think the difficult thing is the classic problem of science communication, which is to make things watchable and enjoyable, but not wrong. You want to try and make things that people are interested in and want to click on the thumbnail of and everything, but also actually do contain content and have meat on the bones. And it's something that I've been flip-flopping on backwards and forwards. And I think as a scientist, I always veer towards making things too complicated and too dry and not flashy enough. And yeah, that's the fundamental challenge of trying to do any form of science communication. And it's something that I'm getting better at, but I'm still not very, very good at.
Yeah. I can see how that can be a challenge, of course. It is. I think it might be similar to when you have a paper and then you have co-authors, so you have to give it to them and they have to also give their own input. Maybe something similar to that.
Yeah.
All right. But actually, I would like to ask you, what are some of the cool things, something really great that happened during your career as a science communicator?
I've had some. It's funny you should ask this now, actually, because I just recently got a bunch of photos printed. Because I'm sure, like everybody, you know, going through your life, you find yourself in a situation. You think, oh, let me take a picture of this so I can remember it, or I'm somewhere cool. Let me take a picture, and I just ended up with loads of these on my phone. So I got about 100 photos printed the other day that I'm going to put up on the wall. And looking back through those, it made me really appreciate, like, wow, this is. These past couple of years have had some amazing opportunities. So, you know, two days after I submitted my thesis, actually, I was in New York for a conference of, well, not a conference, like a gathering, I suppose, of educational YouTubers from around the world, which was really, really awesome. More kind of scientifically, I've been to the Central Laser Facility in the UK. I've been to CERN. I gave a talk about science communication there, which was an amazing privilege. And I also filmed a video at the Antimatter Factory, which was one of the most amazing sort of places on Earth in terms of, like, when you actually think about what they are doing. And then, you know, I have made a habit of trying to go out to talk to students at different student societies and universities. So spoken, you know, Oxford and Cambridge and Imperial. I just came back recently, actually, from a trip to Norway. I took the train from where I am here in Bath over 3 or 4 days, going from here all the way up to Trondheim in Norway.
Wow.
Which was an amazing, amazing experience, and only able to do that because they were willing to cover some of the transport costs, and also because I was making a video about it. And on the way back from that trip, I swung by Stockholm to hang out with some friends of mine and one of whom is Greta Thunberg, who we did a podcast episode together. And just kind of out of the blue, she messaged me one day, and it turned out she was a fan of the podcast. So, you know, her and Isabel Axelsson were showing me around Stockholm, which was one of these kind of pinch yourself moments where you think, how have I ended up in this situation with two people who I genuinely, like, you know, very friendly with? We were just sort of chatting like any other kind of friends, and yet, you know, that they are some of the most famous activists on the planet, and actually making a real difference to a really, really serious problem. So that was awesome. It's been really wild in terms of the places and I've been and people I've seen. I mean, the other big trip, I suppose, was I went to Korea just before, a couple of months before the pandemic happened, to film a video about a conference on renewable energy, which was just an overwhelming experience. It was so, so different. And, you know, and that's just the physical places. I mean, I've been able to collaborate with quite diverse people on different video topics, and people that I have watched in my spare time, and in some cases I watched as a teenager and grew up watching, people, including some collaborations that you wouldn't expect. Like, some of them are relatively standard, if you like, collaborations, because it's people like Real Engineering or Tom Scott or these big YouTube channels in science. But then also I have a bunch of friends who do gaming YouTube channels, and we've gotten close over the past couple of years, and being able to inject a little bit of science into their content and host quizzes for them and things like that have been amazing. So the past few years have been really, really cool. I cannot deny I've been very, very lucky with the opportunities I've been given.
That sounds really great. But for the last question, I would like to ask you, do you have any advice for the people who are considering to start a career as a science communicator?
Okay. The most important piece of advice I can give was the hardest piece of advice I was ever given. And that was, let's say you want to make videos. The first 100 videos you make will suck. And you've just got to accept that fact. But once you've made those bad videos, that's the only way that you're able to make your first good video. Because every time you make a bad video, you learn from the experience and you learn what not to do. And sometimes you might do something and it works really well, and so you learn a bit of what to do. But fundamentally, you don't learn unless you try. You don't learn unless you make stuff. And that's not just videos. That's across anything. It's true for writing or acting or music or art or whatever it is. You just have got to do it. The way that you get good at something is to first of all be bad at it and accept that and learn from all the mistakes that you're going to make. And that's, you know, that's actually the hardest hurdle of all. Like, the highest hurdle is just that initial, the first thing that you make, because you've got all these voices in your head saying, this is bad, you don't know what you're doing, you know, just look at yourself, you haven't got a clue what you're doing right now. But once you make it, you look back on what you make and you think, right, oh, okay, I see now that I didn't put the light in the right place, or you can't see me, the background's too bright, or the microphone's too far away from me. And then the second video is a bit better. In fact, actually, it'd be quite a bit better, because you probably learn very quickly at the start. And certainly for me, you know, I look back on my first sort of 100 videos, it's more than 100 actually in my case, and they're bad. They're not good videos. But you can also see that I get better through each one. So it's hard to hear, but accept the fact that if you want to do something and you haven't started doing it, you will suck at it to begin with. But the only way you're going to be good at it is to try and to improve bit by bit. And you will eventually get there. Like, there's a Bob Ross quote, which I really like. I like him for a lot of reasons, but there's a quote from him, which is that talent is nothing more than a pursued interest. And I think there's certain people who, sure, they have a natural affinity for a subject. You get these people who have been playing piano from the age of 4, and they just, you see them at a young age and they're amazing. Great. Okay, you've clearly found something that you are naturally good at. But I don't think I am naturally good at filmmaking. I don't think I'm naturally good at science or writing or any of the things that I do. It's just something that I was too pig-headed to stop doing had enough opportunities, some of which I created myself, some of which I was very generously gifted by the people, to try and fail and get better. And that's the only reason I am where I am now. So the best piece of advice is just to do, to make and to try. And that's how you learn.
Yeah, this is a really great advice, Simon. And I think you are really humble here. But I would like to say that you also wrote a book, right? Is that right? I would like to ask, what exactly is the name and where can people find it?
Oh, cool. So I read a book called Firmament, The Hidden Science of... It's actually behind me on the shelf right now. I'm tilting my head to look at it. The Hidden Science of Weather, Climate Change, and the Air That Surrounds Us. And it's an introduction to, and it's a history of atmospheric science, which I wrote because I was frustrated when you're studying this the subject at university level. You basically just get given equations and a bit of context, but you never learn how we know what we know and how that fits into the broader narrative of science, which I think you miss out on so much. And it also means that you miss out on some of the connection between weather, the atmosphere, and climate change. Because I think there are loads of people who've written books about weather, loads of people who have written about climate change, but no one has written one really about the physical system of the atmosphere for a general audience, which is what I try to do. And you can get that pretty much anywhere. You can get books, really. It's available on Audible. It's available as an ebook. You can get it in physical form everywhere, I think, apart from North America at the moment. And then in September, I think it's coming out in North America.
Mm-hmm. That is so exciting. Thank you very much, Simon, for coming here for the podcast. I really appreciate the time.
No, honestly, my pleasure. Any opportunity to talk about SciComm.
What follows next are some extra bits of conversation with Simon that were recorded after the main part of the podcast.
And I just want to say that I downloaded your book yesterday evening from the Audible store.
Oh, yeah.
So it sounds very interesting. Very, very interesting. I'm really enjoying it.
Good. I mean, I am... It's enough time has passed since writing it that I'm actually pretty happy with it. Like, I'm not perfectly happy, but I think there's room to do another one. Let's put it like that. I wasn't totally put off the process of writing.
That's great to hear. That's really great to hear. And I just want to say that I really have a lot of respect for people who of course write books, but also who are confident enough to read them out loud.
That was a horrible experience.
Really?
Yeah. Really? It's because you're looking through all of your mistakes in minute detail, and you have to read exactly what is on the page.
Right.
So there's no room for trying to fix things afterwards. It's like, this is what you have written and it has to be like this. And it's
all right.
It's a little bit, it makes you feel a little bit powerless.
Yeah. But what I want to say is that I think it's, it creates some sort of connection between the author and the reader. because then it's kind of like a conversation, even though it's only one way, but it's like someone's thoughts, and they're talking to you. So I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think it adds a lot of being the author, for sure, because there's a lot of, certainly the way that I write, I think, is very similar to the way that I speak. And I think if somebody else were to read out my words, I would find it strange. But I think some of the meaning could be lost. Tonally. So it was, and also there is quite a lot of technical terminology in the book, which I think would be difficult for somebody else to get correct. But also, as I found out, there's a lot of different languages represented in in different names. And I really struggled with that. So it's certainly, the process has given me a whole new respect for voice actors and people having to read this stuff for their jobs.
So that concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. And just to say, if you want to learn more about iLeaps, please go to our website, iLeaps.org, where you'll find a link to our early careers website, where you can follow us on Twitter at iLeaps_ECSN, or our Facebook page. Thanks.